You know, I love a library. I've always loved libraries. Oh, sorry. I've always loved libraries. So that's why I'm so excited about this week's meeting of the EdTech Club. We're going to talk... Well, here, come over here. Okay, sorry. Now we can speak a little more freely. Anyway, as I was saying, I've always loved libraries. Public libraries, school libraries, libraries of all types. I just think they're great. I love the fact that you can go somewhere or access something and you've got all this information at your fingertips. It's all shared and you can use it. And of course, we know that a library or a media center can be the heart of any kind of learning community. In your school, it's probably an important physical place and it performs an important function. So whether you're an administrator, classroom teacher, or a librarian or media specialist yourself, you're going to be very interested in this week's guest speaker. In another of our interviews recorded live at TCEA 2020, we speak with Jennifer Lagarde, the author of the blog Adventures of a Library Girl, a world-traveling speaker on library topics, and a librarian. Now, at TCEA this year, she talked about a range of issues, a lot of which touch on digital literacy and digital citizenship. We're going to talk about those vital functions and how she does it, the kinds of tools she uses, and the kinds of skills she's trying to develop in her learners. And of course, it's not just tech tools. We're talking about libraries, so of course we're going to talk about books too. It is a really exciting, broad-ranging, but useful talk, and I think you members of the EdTech Club are really going to like it. So, our discussion with Jennifer Lagarde and all the complexities of librarianship in the 21st century is all coming up, and it all starts right now. Hey everybody, I'm Andrew Rausch. Welcome back to another meeting of the EdTech Club, the podcast from TCEA, and this week, yes, another interview from TCEA Convention and Exposition 2020. This is our conversation with Jennifer Lagarde. We're here with Jennifer Lagarde. Jennifer is a librarian, the author of Adventures of a Library Girl.
Yes, that's true.
You are the library girl.
I am the library girl.
And you're talking this week about a lot of, I would say, big and timely issues.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we know that a library, a media center, is a heart of a school. Everything goes through it. So that role is important. But the things you're talking about might surprise some people, I think. I stopped in on a session you were running this morning about using books to help students tackle tough issues. You did another session this morning about fake news, a phrase we've heard a lot about. And of course, as we think about digital literacy, digital citizenship, all of these things are going to become just more important in everyday life. So what's your perspective in terms of what a librarian does to give someone a handle on the world and know how to interpret information?
Well, first of all, I think libraries have a rich and important history as being one of the few, and certainly one of the few remaining egalitarian institutions left in our world. They're one of the few places that you can walk into and it doesn't matter what you believe, what your skin color is, who you love, what your gender is, how you identify, and you get free equal access to information and resources regardless. And there's lots of places where you can access information, but there's a transaction required, and libraries don't require that. And so that, coupled with the librarian's traditional role as information specialist, information conduit, the person who can connect you with information, to me positions librarians in the perfect spot to help our communities navigate today's news and information landscape, which is so fraught right now. So it feels like a moral imperative to me.
Right, and when we think about technology, we can often think that we're being inundated by information. It's just hard to process, right?
Yeah.
But it also gives us tools to parse that information as
Indeed.
Well, right? So when you think about technology and how it's influencing the role of librarians, what are the wins you're seeing?
Okay, so I think, gosh, this could be a really long conversation, but
I hope so.
I think one of the ways in which technology is a force for good in our world is that despite our tendency to look at people interacting on our devices and think that we're disconnected, in reality, technology provides us an opportunity to connect with people in ways that we never have been able to, and also to access story in ways that we've never been able to before. And that's critically important because stories connect us as human beings. When I know your story, I'm far less likely to judge you in a negative way. When I know your story and you need help, I'm far more likely to help you. It's when I don't have those pieces of the puzzle and I'm able to fill that void with my own biases, my own preconceptions, that I'm less likely, that I'm more likely to separate from you and less likely to help you. So having said that, as librarians who are information specialists and educators in general who are in a position to help engage our kids in deep learning using the tools of today, which are the most exciting tools that have ever been around, we have the opportunity to use these tools for connection. So do you want me to like name check specific technologies?
Please, yeah.
You know, like I'm a huge fan of technologies like Flipgrid that can be used asynchronously to help connect learners around the globe. And I am not a Flipgrid ambassador. I do not get any sort of like kickback from them at all. But I really love how responsive they are to educators. Those of us who've been at this for a while remember when Flipgrid cost a lot of money to use. They are now free because they felt the moral imperative to make sure all kids and all schools, regardless of how the wealth of that school district, would be able to have access. To me, that's an important win. I think more and more ed tech tools are being responsive to districts in that way, knowing that schools and districts don't have a ton of money, and that if they're going to be startups and technology leaders in the education game, that they have to have that moral imperative behind it to serve all.
And so when we think about one of the oldest educational technologies, books.
Yes.
And again, that's an asynchronous thing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's somebody wrote it, and 1,000 years later, we can go back and
Certainly.
See what they were thinking. We can also see what people around us today are thinking. Mm-hmm. As you said, people we may not know much about. Yep. And when we have those empty spaces, well, we fear what we don't know, right?
Correct.
So we can use books as a tool to get students to get to know things they didn't know before, that's education, but get
right.
to know people too.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you talked about this morning in your session about helping kids understand tough topics,
yeah.
what I saw was very broad representation. So that's a piece of it, right? Seeing
mm-hmm.
maybe your culture or your life reflected in a story.
Yes.
But also seeing someone else's that you were not familiar with.
Yes.
So, you had a litany of really wonderful books, and you can talk about those specifically, but generally, what can we get about that out of that? And if you're a librarian, what's your plan to sort of be that conduit and find the right information
right.
for each student or for each classroom?
Well, first of all, just say that I love coming to a technology conference and talking about books. You know, I love bringing analog technology to a high-tech conference like this because to me, it's not a question of do we do one or the other. It's how do we marry both? Like, how do we marry today's tools with the traditional tools that still work really well, like the book? Because it's the story that's the powerful part of that. But getting back to your question, I feel, having spent the last year and a half really immersed in the work of news and media literacy, I feel that there's a deep connection between information literacy in 2020 and social and emotional learning. That is to say, the ability to manage our own emotional responses to information. Because information now, and this is a longer conversation, but information now is really hinged on our emotional response because that's how the creators of information get us to click.
Yeah.
They trigger us. And so that's how they get, and clicks are how people make money in information now, because we don't pay for the newspaper anymore. We don't pay, you know, we won't pay. So we pay this other way. This is the other way that we pay. So all of that being said, since information is so deeply entrenched in emotion and often negative emotions, and because kids today get their news secondhand, either through their parents, and there's baggage that comes along with that, or through social media, which is a whole other filter, then how can we help them recognize their emotional responses to information and navigate those and manage them, right? To me, that's a missing piece in how we do news literacy. So as librarians and as somebody who really, really loves to read and who sees books as still playing an important role in helping kids become better human beings, I think those two resources can go hand in hand. And so as we connect kids with books, we can be thinking about some of the books today which are so, I mean, we're just living in a great time in terms of publishing for young people. We still have a lot of work to do in terms of that representation that you mentioned, but how can we harness those tools to affect this other learning? And I just think that potential is endless.
And, you know, you talk about the connection between reading, between consuming stories, maybe most broadly, and building empathy and social emotional learning. That's something you talked about this morning as well, is that a person who reads is much more likely to be empathetic.
Yes.
Be able to get along with people, mm-hmm. right?
There's tons of research on this. I shared some of it this morning, but there's decades of research about all the ways that reading benefits human beings. Like, everything from physical health, like neurological health is strengthened by being a reader, to not just, you know, like measures on standardized assessments and your income level and the age of, or the level of schooling you'll achieve. All those things are affected by reading, but also other things that just make us better people. Like, readers, we know, build longer lasting relationships with people. Readers are more likely to give to philanthropic causes. Readers are more likely to travel the world but then return home and try to make home better. Like, readers do all of these things, you know, because there's this connective tissue of story that makes people feel a part of the global family, and so therefore they want to make, if a reader understands that the stronger we individually are, the better we are together, you know? And so all of that to say that empathy is a huge driver when it comes to technology use and information literacy, because it can help us think about ways to harness those tools to make the world better. Like, and that's what it's all about. So many of our schools have adopted technology because, like, for the same reason we adopt so many other things, the test. You know, we adopt the tools because testing has gone online. But now that we have them, what are we going to do with them that's more important than that? Now that we have those tools, how can we empower kids to use them to change the world? And when we help our kids become readers, they start seeing and identifying places that need that change.
And getting inspired to create new things, to build, you know, the future, if
mm-hmm,
you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk about something that may prompt a different kind of emotion than empathy,
mm-hmm.
And that's fake news.
Mm-hmm.
That's something you're talking about this week. It's something you've talked about before, and it's something that's an important part of building digital literacy and digital citizenship.
Yeah.
So let's start here. What is fake news?
Okay, well, first of all, fake news is a term I try very hard never to use.
Yes.
Even though it's in the title of the book I wrote for ISTE, shameless plug, it is a term that I think that we talk about in the book and that I try to convey is lazy. That we should be far more specific in thinking about what it is that makes a news story suspicious or what it is that makes a piece of information trigger an emotion for us. So this whole narrative around fake news, to me, is really driven by a desire to discredit people. When we see that term now, it is most often used in order to discredit someone I don't agree with. I don't agree with you, so what you said is fake news. That's just a label that I can quickly slap on it to discredit you. So as educators, one of the things I think we have to really do is expand our vocabulary to include more specific language about what might make information suspicious. Boy, this headline is really clickbaity. This headline contains words that are sort of outrageous, that trigger outrage to me or trigger fear or designed to make me feel that way. Oh my goodness, these images, I can tell they were taken in a way to make something look other than what it really was. Or gosh, the statistics in here look like they are suspicious to me. Those statistics don't make sense. Let me dig a little bit deeper. So we have to identify, gosh, are we looking at clickbait? Are we looking at propaganda? Are we looking at misinformation? Are we looking at the litany of other ways that people alter information to further an agenda? And then when we can identify that, not only do we become better at recognizing it in future information, but we're also better able to have good conversations about it. You know, I said in my last session, so many of us were stressed out about Thanksgiving this year because we were going to hang out with people we'd unfriended on Facebook, right? You know, because of our beliefs being so disparate. Those conversations devolve quickly when we just reduce ourselves to name-calling, which I think the term fake news essentially is. We can have a better conversation if we say, you know, I hear what you're saying. I get why you feel that way. But let me show you why I was suspicious of that. This made me think a little bit more. And I know you're a smart, thoughtful person. I think you'd want to know this. You know, that's a better conversation than fake news, you know, or whatever comes from that. So that's a piece of this puzzle, too, is the vocabulary building, both in ourselves and in our students.
And it seems to me like the skills you would deploy to identify misleading or false information or, you know, simply wrong information.
Right.
Would be the same skills you would use to be a thoughtful and critical reader of any kind.
Yes. I do think that there are specific lenses, though. I would add, I agree with what you're saying, I would add this, that I think there are some specific lenses that we have to apply when we're talking about information that we access on our mobile device. Mm-hmm. Folks who came to my sessions earlier today, like they're getting a repeat of some of my preaching from earlier, but we know that 91% of homes in the United States have access to a smartphone, not just a mobile phone, a smartphone. That far exceeds the level of broadband penetration that we have in this country. So, and we also know that like something like 68% of Americans report getting their news from social media. And we know that when they're getting their news from social media, it's on a mobile device, not on their laptops, not on their computers. And what we talked about today in my session and what we'll talk further about in sessions this week is that the device, the access point through which we access information, that doorway adds layers. How we apply those same critical skills that you're talking about that we apply to any piece of information looks different on a mobile device because there's layers between who's posting it versus who published it, the date it's posted versus the date it's published. How do you find the editorial board for a information source in Snapchat or on TikTok? And y'all, that's where our kids get their news. So, you know, how do we start navigating those layers and helping our kids peel those back? We have to, because otherwise the instruction we provide in the classroom doesn't apply when the research really has higher stakes outside of the classroom. In the classroom, they might be completing an assignment for a grade, but if they don't really know how to find credible information when they're looking up whether or not, or how to contract an STD, or how to report abuse, or how to really find information that is critical to their life and well-being, then we failed them. So we have to think about those layers in addition to what you're saying about the general skills.
And I can even think, you know, that seemingly small difference between looking at Twitter in a browser and seeing something and thinking, oh, that's interesting, and maybe popping open a new tab and searching,
mm-hmm.
or taking the image and putting it in a reverse image search to see if that's really a picture of what you thought it was.
Right.
If you're looking in the Twitter app on your phone, I feel like you're much less likely to go and do that.
It's different. It's a different skill set because it requires different steps. Mm-hmm. And even for kids, like, you know, as an adult, I might think, oh, I should do a reverse image search on this. And then I have to think, how do I do that on this device? Like, I take those steps. But for a kid, that's not transferable all the time. Like, you just don't see the transfer of this is the skill I learned in school, this is the skill I learned in school versus this is what I'm really doing on my device that I carry around with me all the time. You know, so we have to figure out, I think that mobile technology is a piece of this that's missing also that we really need to make sure that we're adding into this kind of instruction.
When you think about technology and how it affects the role of a librarian or a media specialist, what are the positive trends? What are the tools that you think are enhancing mm-hmm. a librarian or media specialist's ability to be that information conduit?
Well, I see, one thing I will say before I directly answer your question is that I'm seeing fewer and fewer librarians and educators in general, but fewer and fewer librarians who are opting out, who are deciding, I don't do technology. And I'm an old lady, so, you know, I've been in this enough where at one point that was the majority of people I knew. I don't do that. You know, I'm the book lady, I want to do story time, or I'm the librarian who wants to do, you know, whatever, but I'm not into the technology. And fewer and fewer people adopt that position, and those who do are being pushed or coached into other positions by their administrators because it's just not an option anymore. Like, that's not an option. And I think that's a good trend. What I will say is I think I see a lot of librarians using technology to end book deserts. My librarians in the room and other educators may have heard that term. We know that it's a branch off the tree of the food desert idea that areas in poverty have so little access to even a grocery store. You might go into neighborhoods or rural areas where there's a pawn shop or a liquor store, but no grocery store. And so you have kids that live in a de facto, like a food desert. The idea behind a book desert is that you have so many kids who come to school without access to their own books at home, that there is not a bookshelf at their house. They've never held a book when they enter kindergarten. There's not a public library in their neighborhood. Or even if there is, for whatever reason, there's barriers between their family and the public library. So they live in a book desert. And one of the most positive ways that I see librarians using technology is to create book floods. If you have these kids with devices, whether it's a phone, it's an iPad, it's a school-issued Chromebooks, librarians are advocating and teaching their communities how to access books on those devices all the time. So that way, even just at their fingertips, kids are able to access reading material. And I think that's a really positive way, a trend that I hope to see even more of.
Something as simple as knowing that there's something like Project Gutenberg, where you can just go read a public domain book.
Yes. And one of the things that's really exciting for me that's been happening over the last few years, and I've worked with several school districts doing this, is that I see a lot of school districts partnering with their public libraries that serve their area to create student library cards that are based on their student number. So this is really important for a couple of reasons. One, because a lot of families who live in poverty have a barrier for checking out materials at the public library. For some, it's because they've lost materials and their account's been blocked. For others, it might be that they're undocumented and the public library is a government agency that they're fearful of going to. There's lots of, for some it's transportation, etc. So when these two public services, the public school and the public library, partner to give kids unfettered access through their own number that is not connected to whatever the family might owe or anything else, then that, just putting that app or bookmarking the public library website in the browser on the Chromebook or whatever, provides families and communities with instant access to a whole other wealth of resources. Some districts use that just to exchange and check out digital resources, but I've been to some districts where kids are able to reserve and check out print resources that are delivered to their schools. And in my own district where we did this, one of the pillars of understanding between the two entities is that we would do this with absolutely zero accrual of library fines, that we would not create another opportunity for a family to owe money because a kid lost a book or whatever. So it's really about deciding that this is important and paying more than just lip service to the idea that we want kids to be readers and that literacy is important, and then making the decisions and creating those partnerships to really make it happen. And technology can make that easier in ways that have never been possible before.
I have one kind of random question.
Sure.
I just want to get your take on it.
Yeah.
Audiobooks.
Yes.
What do you think of them?
Love them.
Yeah, they're pretty cool.
Yes, and it's not just me who loves them. There's new research. There's been other research, but recently Scientific American released a study in which they took explored the neural patterns of your brain, what happens in your brain when you're listening to a story versus when you're reading through your eyes, and guess what, folks? They're the same. So, like, your brain doesn't know whether or not you're looking at it, the text, or you're hearing it, and so when we're talking about reading for independent reasons, independent reading, either for practice or for pleasure or for developing stamina in reading, there's literally no difference to your brain between the audio and the print text. Now, if you're in the classroom and you are teaching guided reading and you're teaching vocabulary, then obviously the print text holds that purpose. But for in terms of independent reading, we have to stop the practice of thinking that audiobooks aren't real reading because your brain doesn't think that. So
yeah, and you know, I think there was something going around Twitter recently about somebody discovering that inner monologues were real.
Mm-hmm.
Like some people don't have an inner monologue;
right.
They don't hear their own voice in their head, and others do.
Yeah,
and I think for people, you know, I talked to my wife about this. She doesn't have an inner monologue, and I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
And I thought,
that's creepy.
How does this affect the way you read? Because she will often ask me to read something for her. And I might be thinking, yeah, that is creepy. What's going on in your brain? But in fact helps her a lot.
Yeah.
Because there's something going on with how she's processing it visually versus hearing it.
Exactly.
But if she hears it, she'll get it immediately, right? She can repeat it.
Absolutely. And there's so much, again, there's lots of research around this about how having the audio, especially if we're talking about kids, and particular kids who need some scaffolding around reading still, having the audio along with the print text allows their brain to focus on creating the visual that goes along with making meaning and context. So if a kid is struggling with the pronunciation of words, with combining syllables, with all of those things, then their brain doesn't get to perform that vital function of developing the visual that helps create context. So for those kids who need scaffolding especially, the audiobook is just a wonderful way to provide that. There's also additionally some research, though, about how audiobooks provide the opportunity for kids who aren't struggling with those to then make deeper meaning from the text, to think about things like metaphor, to think about things like how the text connects to real-world issues, because their brain is freed up to do that. So audiobooks are a powerful tool, and I'm team audio.
Team audio.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Well, it's a good thing you're on a podcast.
Exactly.
Before you go, one, thank you for taking the time.
Oh, thank you.
You're very busy. 10, 11 sessions?
10 sessions plus a couple of these other things.
Yeah, so check your programs. But before you go, I guess I wanted to give you the opportunity to plug where people can keep up with you. If
sure.
This was intriguing to folks, where do they learn more?
Well, people who do keep up with me know that email is the least effective way to find me. So even though my email is out there, don't use it. I won't respond, at least not soon. So there's that. But really the best way to keep up with me is either on my website, which is librarygirl.net, or I respond very quickly to messages on Twitter, Instagram, other social media. Those I get notifications about and am quick to reply. So, and plus, I just feel like one of the great joys for me of being able to do this work is everywhere I go, I grow my posse, right? You know, like we're all connected now. So please connect with me. It's an honor when people choose to be a part of this journey with me, and it's a thrill to be able to do that for you too.
Well, it was an honor to have you here today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jennifer Lagarde.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So that wraps up our conversation with this week's guest speaker for the club, Jennifer Lagarde. And hey, good news, I'm not giving you any homework this week, but if you do want to learn a little bit more, of course, I have, as usual, some useful links in the show notes, the episode description for this episode. You can find that in your podcast player or on our website, tcea.org/edtechclub. And your podcast player or that website are great places to subscribe to the show so you can keep up if you want to be a member in good standing of the EdTech Club. And if you do enjoy it, don't forget to rate and review us in your podcast player, Apple Podcasts. It really helps us out. And don't forget to connect with TCEA on all your favorite social media applications. And if you really want to connect with the podcast, you can send your comments about librarianship, digital literacy, digital media, hardback books, whatever you find interesting, send it to podcast@tcea.org. And little secret, folks who send in interesting tidbits to the podcast email box, well, they get a little bit of what we call extra credit. So be on the lookout. We might shout you out in a future episode. And while you're keeping up with TCEA, if you're interested in the use of educational technology at the elementary level, maybe you're an elementary teacher, librarian, or administrator, you're going to want to be a part of TCEA's Elementary Technology Conference. That is this summer, June 14 through 16, in beautiful beachside Galveston, Texas. It is a unique and powerful event for educators who work with the youngest learners. It is a vital time in life, as we know. There are a lot of changes going on from grade to grade, from classroom to classroom, from student to student, as we know. And at the conference, we're going to be talking to you about all the ways we can deploy tech to keep up with these changes. So don't forget to check it out. And as a note, early bird pricing for the ETC, as we call it, the Elementary Technology Conference, ends on April 2nd. So don't forget to check it out to have a little professional development fun in the sun this summer at the Elementary Technology Conference. Okay, I can't hold you any longer. We are off the clock, so you are free to go. But don't forget to return next week for another meeting of the EdTech Club. We'll have more exciting interviews in the weeks to come with some of the biggest names in educational technology. So, once again, don't forget to subscribe and keep up with us. And we'll see you then. Until then, I'm Andrew Rausch. Thanks for being a part of the club. EdTech Club is a production of TCEA. To learn more and to join, go to tcea.org.